Thank you. Again, for those of you who have just joined us, welcome to today's Research to Practice webinar hosted by the SPRC Training Institute. At this moment, about 204 people are connected to this webinar, and I'm delighted to report that almost 400 people registered to attend from 47 U.S. states and Puerto Rico, as well as a number of different countries around the world. A hearty welcome to all of you. We're glad you could be here. And now to our presentation. Today, we are very fortunate to have Linda Langford, Madeline Gould, and Ken Norton with us. First, we'll hear from Dr. Langford, who has been an evaluation scientist with the Suicide Prevention Resource Center since 2006, where she co-directed the Best Practices Registry for Suicide Prevention from 2006 to 2010. Dr. Langford has conducted numerous trainings and workshops for civilian and military suicide prevention practitioners on the topics of safe and effective messaging, stigma reduction, and science-based strategic communications. She currently serves as a subject matter expert on a U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs National Stigma Reduction Campaign led by Rheingold Incorporated. Since 1998, Dr. Langford has also been an Associate Center Director for the U.S. Department of Education's Higher Education Center for Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Violence Prevention, where she has managed the center's evaluation and violence prevention initiatives. So, Tiffany, if you could please unmute Linda's line, we'll get started with the presentations. Linda, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yep, there you are. Go right ahead.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the webinar. Thanks so much for joining us. And I'm happy to get us started today. Let me just see if I have control of the slides yet. There we go. So our presentation is in three parts today. We're going to start by talking about what we're defining as suicide narratives in the news media. Then we'll do a fairly large section on research and theory that speak to the question of how media narratives might have an effect on suicide. And Maddie Gould will do the first part of that presentation, and then it'll come back to me for the second part. And then we'll turn it over to Ken Norton to talk about taking action. So first to defining suicide narratives. We're going to start with a poll. This will come up on your screen, and you'll click the answer that you think is most correct. Based on media coverage that you've seen, which statement would you say best describes the problem of military suicide? Is it that suicidal behavior is very common among service members, that crisis help is readily available for suicidal personnel in the military, that nearly 100% of military personnel find positive ways to cope, or that top military leaders have received mental health treatment and continue to be in leadership positions? So I'll give you a moment to answer that. And while you're answering, I'll just point out that each of these answers offers a different way of viewing the problem of military suicide. And it's these kinds of overarching themes are all examples of a narrative as we're defining it for the webinar. So the way that we're conceptualizing this idea may or may not correspond to other uses of the term narrative that you might see, but this is what we mean when we're talking about it today. And so, Tiffany, if we can see the results from the poll. So most of you picked, 85% of you picked the first one, that suicidal behavior is common. I'm very pleased that 10% of you have seen that crisis help is readily available, and really only 2% of you saw that each of the last two. So this really is the idea that we're talking about, that there's kind of a prevailing way that the news media has been talking about this problem, and that to the extent that this is kind of a repeated and reinforced story, this can kind of become a narrative. So let's go on to the next slide. So for this webinar, this is the idea, this is an example, again, of what we just saw, that the suicide narrative is a basic storyline told repeatedly about how or why suicide happens. And often narratives pertain to specific groups, in this case, military and veterans, but they may also relate to general patterns or causes of suicide. This is another example. This is more less around a group and more around an issue. This is an example around the financial crisis. So we know from research that economic downturns, kind of in a large sense, are associated with an increase in suicidal behavior. But we also know that this relationship is confounded and perhaps mediated by lots of other factors like mental illness, substance abuse, availability of support systems, access to health insurance, and other risk and protective factors for suicide. So if we're really going to think about the causes of suicide, we would need to really look at the mechanisms through which a financial crisis might lead to suicide. So we're not saying today that narratives are wholly untrue or are kind of complete myths or fabrications, but only that there's a focus on one factor that's associated with suicide or kind of one causal dynamic to the exclusion of others. And it may also imply that the relationship is kind of inevitable. And here's a third example about suicide among LGBT students. This particular narrative has focused most recently on bullying as the cause of suicide. So sometimes, again, it's kind of a simple cause-effect relationship. If you're LGBT, an LGBT youth in particular, you know, it's fairly common for you to attempt or complete suicide. Sometimes it's focused around a causal factor like bullying. So where do narratives come from? Here's just some examples. Sometimes there's a kind of focus on the results of a study. Many of our studies focus on one factor, and sometimes reporting on a study of one factor with suicide as a predictor of suicide can result in conveying that factor as the only or primary factor. You've already seen examples of very normalizing language, that there's epidemic or there are hordes of people dying by suicide. And in some cases, and I'll come back to this, one incident becomes a reference point for a particular narrative and frames later stories. And that can kind of interact as well with the study results. So there may be a study and then a high-profile case, and those two reinforce one another. So we want to ask the question, do these kind of media narratives, as we're defining them, affect suicidal behavior? So to our knowledge, there isn't any research on this, sort of direct research on this specific question. However, we can look at relevant research in theory and ask the question, how might narratives affect prevention-related attitudes and behaviors? And we'll sort of examine four main areas. Maddie Gould will talk about the first two. The third is a kind of set of concepts that I consider overlapping but somewhat distinct, and then I'll also talk about the last one. So at this time, I will turn it over to Maddie.
Thank you, Linda, and as you said, we'll come back to you in a moment. And this is Ellie again. I just wanted to introduce Dr. Madeline Gould, who is a professor in psychiatry and epidemiology at Columbia University, a research scientist at the New York State Psychiatric Institute, and deputy director of the research training program in child psychiatry at Columbia University and the New York State Psychiatric Institute. Dr. Gould has led numerous studies in such areas as teen suicide risk factors, cluster suicides, the impact of the media on suicide, effects of peer suicides, postvention in schools, and the utility of telephone crisis services. She has been part of numerous state and national government commissions and authored the chapter on youth suicide prevention for the Surgeon General's 1999 Call to Action to Prevent Suicide. Dr. Gould is the author of numerous articles and the recipient of many awards and has a strong commitment to applying her research to program and policy development. So, Tiffany, if you could please unmute Maddie's line.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thanks.
Great.
Go ahead.
Thanks. Well, today I'll be presenting the empirical basis of our concern about suicide narratives in the media. And I go a little too fast. Yep. Two main concerns that we have about these narratives and their impact are the promulgation of misinformation and misperceptions, as well as the promotion of suicide contagion and modeling. And I'll start with the empirical basis of our concern, you know, about misinformation and misperceptions, using the example of LGBT youth that was mentioned just a bit earlier, that we do know from cross-sectional and longitudinal epidemiologic studies that young people who identify themselves as LGBT youth are at a significant increased risk. It ranges from 2- to 6-fold increase, and that increases the risk of suicidal attempts. So that's a fact. However, we also know that suicide risk is substantially mediated by depression, alcohol abuse, family history of attempts, and victimization in this population. We also know that few suicide deaths are accounted for by LGBT youth. And furthermore, most youths who report same-sex sexual orientation report no suicidality at all. And so among high school students, we're talking about young people who identify as LGBT youth, 85% of males have no suicidality, 72% of females have no suicidality. And that I could have given other examples with regard to the link between bullying and suicide, and we've done quite a bit of research in the area, where you get similar misperceptions and misinformation in the media without the you know, true facts of the association. So I wanted to at least briefly share with you that the facts are more complicated than the direct causality of sexual orientation to suicide, and that the narrative needs to reflect these facts. They need to reflect these facts because there are consequences to misinformation. The message of the narrative can impact on suicide contagion and modeling behavior, which I'll now focus on. Before I present the empirical basis for, you know, or the research that's available on suicide contagion and modeling, I do want to open this up to a poll, and I'm going to ask you to consider whether you think this statement is true or false. The statement starts with, "While anecdotal reports suggest that one suicide can lead to others, is it true or false that current research is insufficient to empirically support the existence of suicide contagion and modeling?" So again, we know there's anecdotal reports, but is there really enough research to support it empirically? So please select whether you think that this statement is true or false. Since it's just a true-false question, I think that we can look at the responses as a quick poll. So I'm not sure how to show
Tiffany,
those.
Can you close the poll and show? Thanks.
Okay, well, this is actually a, you know, slightly more people are saying that it's true that current research is insufficient to empirically support the existence of suicide contagion and modeling. And that's a much closer split than we saw with regard to what people have been seeing in the media. So what I'm going to do today is to present the what evidence there is out there, and then we can decide together whether there's sufficient or insufficient evidence to support suicide modeling. That research consistently finds a significant increase in suicide after nonfictional stories and fictional stories, but there's less research devoted to the influence of fictional stories. With regard to non-fictional stories, and by that I mean stories in that are reported in newspapers and television, and more recently research on internet reports, there are over 50 studies examining the impact of these, you know, of these non-fictional reports. And we don't have time for me to go into detail about each one of the studies individually, but I've provided references to review publications of these studies in the resource slide at the end of my presentation. From these really quite numerous now number of studies focusing on, and I will be focusing on non-fictional stories because there's much more work in this area, that research finds an increase in suicide when the frequency of stories increases, when the prominence of the story increases, for example, the story being on the front page of a newspaper, and when the headlines are dramatic. I've highlighted the first finding in red because it's particularly relevant to narratives where there usually are many, many stories that are published about the same narrative. That research has mainly reported on what I call direct effects. In other words, an increase in, and usually it's completed suicides that they're examining, though it's true for attempted suicides as well, following stories. So more suicides following the stories. But there are also other studies that have reported converse effects, and by that I mean a decrease in suicides either following the development and dissemination of media guidelines or a decrease during newspaper strikes. And one of the earliest studies of the impact of newspaper reports of suicide on, imitative, what's sometimes called imitative suicides, actually tested this converse effect. This was way back in 1967 by Motto, and he showed a significant reduction in suicide during the a newspaper strike, in that there was the suppression of newspaper reports. You know, sometimes people question, and that was the question that I posed to you, whether the evidence is really sufficient to consider the association between media coverage and suicide to be causal. This slide shows several dimensions that researchers use to assess causality. And we don't have the time today to go through each of these criterion in detail, but the upshot is that there's a lot of evidence to support three of the five. With regard to the consistency of the findings, so that, across different studies finding the same thing, the strength of the association, and the coherence, or it making sense, with regard to modeling behavior. And while there's not as much evidence for the criterion of temporality and specificity, the available research does support these criteria as well. So that we really do consider that the weight of the evidence makes it reasonable to regard the media-suicide relationship as causal. I realize I'm going through this very quickly, and so for definitions of each of these dimensions, I've put the references that cite this particular study, but this is where it all started with regard to this article by Hill, and so if you're interested, you should go to this reference. And given this very consistent, strong, coherent, association between the media and subsequent suicides, at least for non-fictional stories about, real people who've died by suicide, when you think back to the poll where actually the majority of people thought, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there was certainly a close to 50-50 split, so there were very, very many people who thought that there was not sufficient evidence, and I, hope that this quick overview and then the references at the end of the last slide of this presentation will provide you with enough evidence to feel confident that there is sufficient evidence to empirically support the existence of suicide contagion and modeling. But even though we feel confident that there does exist, media's impact on suicide, there are clearly interactive factors that also exist. So the characteristics of both the audience and the stories are important. With regard to the nature of the audience, we're particularly concerned about vulnerable people, such as depressed youth, who might be more susceptible to suicide modeling. With regard to the stories, I've already mentioned some characteristics of stories that are of particular concern, and in the next few slides I'll be going into a little more detail about that. On this slide, I've highlighted the, you know, quote, match between the audience and the story, or the, you know, the model in the story, because we are concerned that specific people will identify with the narrative. And that's what this differential identification refers to, that the similarity between the audience and the story's model will lead to heightened identification, and that heightened identification has been shown to increase the vulnerability to modeling the behavior. And so research has shown that individuals who share characteristics with the models in stories are more apt to model their behavior. And unfortunately, in this, you know, the situation that we're talking about is the behavior they're modeling is death by, or, you know, suicide or suicide attempts. That I want to briefly talk about content analyses of suicide stories to see if we can get some understanding of specific aspects of media stories that might facilitate suicide contagion. Unfortunately, the research in this area is limited. Most studies that have examined newspaper characteristics have focused on what we would call quantitative aspects of stories, such as the placement of the story in the newspaper and other formatting elements. I'm going to present a couple of examples of content analytic studies that have focused on qualitative aspects of stories. So that one study qualitatively examined suicide newspaper reports from 6 countries with very different suicide rates. And in the parentheses, you can see the countries that were studied. The main finding was that attitudes towards suicide in these newspaper reports varied by country. For example, in Hungary, the stories were more accepting of suicide, and they were relatively more positive and, quote, even had romantic nature to them. The Japanese media also presented a more positive portrayal of suicide victims, often as a hero. And these two societies have the highest rates of suicide. The remaining countries characterized suicide in more negative terms, portraying the victim and the act in terms of psychopathology, abnormality, and describing the negative consequences of the suicide. I don't mean to, you know, put a stigma on psychopathology or the medical model, but it definitely was portrayed in a less, positive manner than Hungary or Japan stories. We conducted the second study that I'll briefly describe. We aim to identify specific features in media suicide reports that may contribute to the initiation of teenage suicide clusters. And we developed a content analytic strategy that would code both quantitative and qualitative characteristics from newspaper stories. We've shared this abstract form with other folks. In fact, just yesterday by chance, someone emailed me for a copy of it. So if anyone on the webinar is interested in seeing it, you can just email me. The study compared 51 youth cluster communities to 101 matched non-cluster communities. Again, we don't have time to go into detail about the methodology of the study, but there's a reference to the content analysis in the resource slide that I've provided. So I'm just going to summarize the main findings, which were our finding that there was a greater number of non-fictional newspaper stories following the first victim in a cluster compared to the number of stories following a suicide of a youth whose death was not followed by any additional suicides. And by that I mean these non-cluster communities. So if you have two young people, two different communities, one young person dies by suicide and his or her death has many stories, that's more apt to lead to subsequent youth suicides and create a cluster, then the situation where it's clearly tragic death of a young person, but whose death was not followed by additional suicides. You won't see as many stories about that victim in that situation. And that we also found a greater number of stories about actually that first victim in the cluster. The other findings was that were that we found more prominent coverage following the first victim in the cluster with regard to story placement, size of headlines, presence of the picture. And the reason that I've highlighted that in red is to reinforce the earlier findings that I presented on the impact of the frequency of reports, and again highlighting how narratives may be problematic. We also found more sympathetic coverage of the victim with regard to both the content and the picture that was often accompanying the article. No explanation of suicide other than mentioning school or work problems were provided, and we saw more personal details were provided actually about the victim. So what should we do? Well, we do know that there have been recommendations that have been developed for media reporting about suicide. And I've been privileged to be part of those efforts, as has Ken, and Ken will be going into much more detail about what we can do. But just overall, the major aims of the media recommendations are to increase media's positive role to educate the public and shape their attitudes, correctly about risk for suicide and what they can do to prevent suicide, and to also increase stories that minimize contagion. And my last slide before the resource slide is to show evidence of media guidelines' effectiveness in reducing suicide. That the slide shows that it is possible to modify, the likelihood of modeling, and that in 1987, media guidelines were implemented in Vienna. And these guidelines focused on subway suicides because this method was the most prevalent means of suicide in Vienna. And so the development of very direct recommendations, I mean, in the U.S. we call them recommendations. In Vienna, they were able to call them guidelines with regard to how they would report a story and then trying not to report the story. And that you can see that there was a 75% decrease in suicides in the Vienna subway system following the implementation of the guidelines. So this resource slide, which, you'll be able to download, does provide some summaries of what I've presented and, the evidence in more detail. And I will just pose this, if anybody has questions before we continue with Ken's part of the webinar.
Thank you so much, Maddie. That was a wonderful overview in a very short time about what we know about media coverage of suicide and the evidence around its effects. Again, we'll be pausing now for a few questions for Dr. Gould. And as a reminder, you can type your questions into the question pane on your screen. And we actually got one question while you were talking. The question is there also an increase, even when the story does not explicitly identify cause of death as suicide, but rather unidentified cause of death or tragic accident?
Most of the, that's a great question. Most of the research, by virtue of what they're, trying to examine, which was suicide, has focused on stories where the suicide is specifically mentioned. There are some studies earlier on by David Phillips who did show that some, what he had at the time called, quote, disguised suicides, sort of gave the impression that people died by suicide because of virtue of being a single car, single occupant car accident, and that there were increases following those stories as well. But most of the evidence has examined stories where, you know, suicide was explicitly mentioned. So we don't know the extent to which, not saying suicide per se, but getting enough information that it's obvious it is a suicide, whether that will have an impact. We do know that details about methods seem to increase the likelihood of modeling as well. You know, anything that will increase that identification mm-hmm. and knowledge, you know, is something that we're concerned about.
We have a few more questions coming in. And a couple of people are asking about whether the research is current enough to be valid around media influence and around other kinds of media like web published news and broadcast news, and whether the evidence is sort of valid for some of the newer media outlets.
That's just starting. What we have seen, though, that those studies are at least consistent. So that there has been, you know, not a slew, but there have been, you know, with at least looking at, you know, internet reports, there have been at least three large-scale population studies that have looked at, you know, community suicide statistics, or national, in some cases national or cross-national suicide statistics, and looking at the prevalence of, you know, internet use. There have been other studies that have looked at on an individual level, teenagers' reports of their exposure to suicide via social media and chat, and that it seems as if sites with, you know, being exposed to someone on a chat had, you know, these are just now, so whereas with the newspapers and television, I'm talking about, you know, 50 studies or more. Here I'm talking about a handful of studies. But they have been showing this similar consistency. But we have so much, and that's where now the next 5 years of research will be. We'll be focusing on, you know, internet reports. Methodology is a little harder to study the impact. But there's no reason to think that some of the blogs or news reports on the internet would be different. But the evidence certainly needs to be, you know, found in the next 5 years, you know, reported on.
Great. Well, thank you. And there's some other great questions coming in, and we'll have to get to them towards the end of the webinar. We need to move on. So for the moment, we're going to go back to Dr. Langford. So Tiffany, if you could please unmute Linda's line. Linda, are you there?
I'm here.
Great.
Okay. Just getting control of the slides here. Way. Oh, there we go. Sorry. Now we're advancing. So I'm going to continue our research and theory discussion by talking about some, kind of three different areas of research fairly briefly, which I think are a bit overlapping, but also still come from our distinct ideas and come from different literatures. I'm going to start by talking about social norms, which are defined as implicit or informal rules about what is normal or typical in terms of behavior and beliefs in a given group or setting. And so norms are specific to a context. So we have different norms for behavior and beliefs at work versus at home, for example. Social norms are found in various behavioral theories, and some of the writing occurs in the context of talking about those theories and testing them. And then there's other literature about social norms that's really sort of just looking at them on their own outside the context of broader theories. There are two main types of social norms. Descriptive norms refer to behavior or what most people do. And I'm talking about most people because we're talking about what's normal or typical. Injunctive norms refer to attitudes or what most people approve of or think is acceptable or think is cool. So there can be different reference attitudes, but injunctive norms kind of always refer not to what people are doing, but what people think about something. Both descriptive and injunctive norms can refer to suicidal behaviors. So we can talk about whether most people in a group are prone, you know, to attempting suicide, or we can talk about injunctive norms, what their attitudes are about suicidal behaviors, and then we can also think about descriptive and injunctive norms with regard to coping. When thinking about norms, it's important to distinguish between actual and perceived norms, because research finds that our perceptions of social norms often are inaccurate. And this graph really shows that well. These are data that I collected from high school students and asked them about the frequency of their drinking in the past 30 days. So this was a completely anonymous survey, no way to trace it back to them. And we did some checks to see if the results were accurate, and generally we think they were. And you can find this same kind of graph, if you ask the questions in this way, across a range of populations and behaviors. So we asked them, how much did you personally drink in the last 30 days? How many days? And you can see that the actual number, the most typical response, was 0 days. And then it kind of drops off from there. Then we asked them, to what extent do you think other students in your school drank in the last 30 days? And you can see that their perceptions of what other people were doing were much higher than what their actual behavior was. So research that's been conducted on a whole array of other health issues, including drug use, safe sex, physical exercise, and other issues like littering and volunteering, paying taxes, that research finds that people often overestimate unhealthy behaviors and attitudes, like the graph I just showed you with alcohol, and they also underestimate healthy behaviors and attitudes, and that these perceived norms, whether they're right or wrong, are one predictor of behavior. So as Maddie mentioned earlier, there are factors that moderate this relationship. So what she said about differential identification is sort of similar to the group identity finding here, that the strength of the association between perceived norms and behavior has to do whether you identify with the group whose norms we're talking about, and also whether the norm is one that's salient to you. So thinking about suicide and social norms, a relatively few, but some recently, studies have examined norms in the way that I've just defined and kind of operationalized them in terms of measurement. For example, the sources of strength intervention that was evaluated by Wyman and colleagues successfully set out to and did increase adaptive norms among adolescent youth, including perceptions of adult support for suicidal youths and perceived acceptability of seeking help. I would argue also that there's a lot in the suicide prevention research that probably are similar concepts to these normative ones, but they have been called different conceptual names. So that if you think about stigma research, there's a lot within that research about what other people will think if I go to treatment, sort of thing. That seems to be very similar to an injunctive norm, although we'd have to do the measurement to see if it's getting at the same concept. It's similar with peer influences. Not all peer influences are related to the perceived norms that I'm talking about, but some definitely are. So we don't, again, at this point, have the research to say that media narratives specifically, that we can draw that one-to-one relationship between media narratives and social norms, but I would assert that narratives have the potential to convey or reinforce inaccurate norms about both suicidal behavior and then also things like coping behaviors, service availability, being helpful to other people who might be in crisis. So continuing this discussion, let me just go back one, the literature on cultural scripts, kind of a different research tradition. A lot of this work has been conducted by Sylvia Canetto, and she has looked specifically at scripts around suicide. So scripts are culturally specific models and rules for behavior, and with regard to suicide would be specific conditions under which suicidal behavior is expected and by whom and with what means and under what circumstances, etc. And here's how she talks about the effects of scripts on behavior. She says, when suicidal behavior becomes a possibility, these scripts, transformed and individualized, provide a blueprint for action. So again, this has some concurrence with what Maddie talked about earlier in terms of vulnerable individuals, that we're not talking about creating risk where there really isn't any potential for risk, but rather if there's an individual that's feeling suicidal, that this could be a potentially dangerous roadmap. And so again, we don't have direct evidence to say, okay, a media narrative equals a cultural script equals increased suicide risk, but I think what we've showed you about media narratives really sounds very similar to this work on cultural scripts, and I would argue that the media does help perpetuate or create scripts or has the potential to show alternate storylines, and we'll come back to that in Ken's portion. And then a third area, which again is kind of a completely separate literature, is from communication and media studies, in which there's a large literature that examines how media influences the public, and one key issue is framing. So the idea is that any issue can be viewed in multiple ways, and the frame is that part of the media package that provides a central organizing idea for making sense of events, and that may include all of the elements that are listed there. It may be about problem definition. It may be about the kind of causal interpretation that we've alluded to a few times. It could be the kind of right or wrongness. It could be what solution is appropriate. And there's some other factors that are listed there that are kind of part of the mix around framing. One sort of particular concept within the framing literature is this idea of a media template that Kitzinger created. And again, I think this is very relevant when we talk about suicide narratives. A media template is a high-profile story that's kind of a shared understanding among an audience and the media that's used to make sense of later events. So if we talk about another Watergate or another Vietnam, people kind of have a set of associations with what is the narrative about that, who are the players, what was the cause and effect, et cetera, and that these narratives become reference points both for news sources and for audiences. So I talked earlier about how a narrative can be formed by kind of referring back to a high-profile incident. And so if we live in a world where people are going to start talking about another Tyler Clementi, again, these can be templates for a certain kind of script around suicide. So I presented three ideas that are kind of more theoretical and empirical, and I also want to sort of present a practical matter, which is that the opportunity cost argument, that as long as we're focusing on the negative narrative, that means we're not telling stories of positive coping and receiving help and services are available, et cetera. And so does this matter? Well, there's not a lot of research that speaks to that specifically, but there is one 2010 study that looked at the content of these studies and looked at protective as well as potentially protective as well as harmful reporting characteristics. And they categorized articles into four classes or categories, and only one of those categories overall was associated with less suicide following the stories on balance. And they called that the mastery of crisis category. And those were articles that described the adoption of coping strategies other than suicidal behavior in the face of adverse circumstances and commonly talked about suicidal ideation but without suicidal behavior. So the authors hypothesized that this talking about ideation might allow the audience to identify but then kind of follow a different path with it to go in a direction of coping rather than suicidal behavior. Now, one important factor is that those Mastery of Crisis articles also tended to have fewer of the characteristics of harmful reporting that Maddie described than other types. But again, that doesn't explain why there would be actually less suicide on balance following those. So that's one small piece of evidence. Again, needs replication, et cetera, but I think is a really important area for us to be looking at. And then the second kind of overall argument around opportunity cost comes from really a whole body of literature around behavior change and effective communications that tells us that positive behavior is more likely when messages and educational content promotes specific actions people can take, conveys the benefits of, you know, and how taking those actions will pay off, reduces the barriers or helps people figure out how to navigate around the barriers, increases people's perceived capability to act, and other, you know, kind of similar action-promoting kinds of messaging. And, you know, broadly speaking, we know that suicide prevention, to succeed in that, we need to promote protective factors and reduce risk factors. So to the extent that narratives are not doing any of these things, they're sort of a missed opportunity to, you know, they're probably more in line with suicide, increasing suicide risk rather than suicide prevention. So that was a very quick and dirty overview of a couple of different concepts I think are relevant to the media narrative discussion. So Maddie told you earlier that there is a causal relationship between media and suicide. We can't yet say that there's a causal relationship between media narratives and suicide, but we feel like it's at least plausible to say that narratives have the potential to perpetuate misinformation, increase the likelihood of contagion factors, normalize suicidal behavior and lack of help, and contribute to other kinds of misperceived norms that we think would discourage people from seeking help, could contribute to or even create a behavioral script for specific groups, and that in some cases may be driven by a template event that's repeated over and over, and that kind of fill the news space with the kind of negative narrative rather than other kinds of more positive stories of help and resilience. So there's about 5 slides here, so when you download them, you can see 2 slides for accurate content and then 3 reference slides for my section. And so while I page through these, if anybody has any questions, we'll take a couple of before we turn it over to Ken Norton to talk about taking action.
Thanks, Linda. That's a lot of pulling together of a lot of different strands to really give us a picture of how narratives might affect norms and behaviors. And I did want to mention before we take a few more questions that the presentation slides have been posted, and you can find the link in the chat box that's near the Q&A box and your little screen on the right-hand side. But if you have additional questions on sort of what we've had so far, please do type them into the question box. And there was one that came in while you were talking, Linda, from a reporter that I'm going to try to summarize because it's pretty long. But basically, she tries to report on the gaps in treatment, focus on mental health, as well as telling the story of what happened. So she's asking, how does a reporter ask and answer what went wrong while being sensitive to the research and guidelines you suggest?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question, and I do understand for if there's other reporters as well on the line, I understand that you have a job to do and that you know your job has to do with not just featuring what went right, but talking about specific incidents. So I do understand that, and I think Ken will provide more insight about this as well. But what I would say is if there's a way to kind of provide the counter narrative as just to help or keep people oriented, if you're telling a kind of negative outcome story, if there's a way to ask an answer about the positive side of this isn't necessarily the typical, you know, results in this context, and here are some things, you know, here's resources that are available, and in some cases, if there's a story of where somebody in a similar situation where things went well for that person, and I think those can be harder to find as stories, but I think that's also an important kind of counterbalancing to do. And then I think just providing resources, prevention resources, where people, if they're in crisis, especially a crisis number, so if people are in crisis, and just let them know that hope and help is available, I think that can be very helpful in counterbalancing this kind of, you know, sort of pure negative narrative.
Great. We've also gotten a couple of questions about the evidence that you and Maddie have presented about whether it is relevant for populations of color, particularly American Indians and Alaska Natives. And I don't know if there's any specific research around those populations.
I don't know if Maddie is unmuted. If she can, she can answer a bit.
Could you unmute Maddie as well and keep Linda on?
In terms of the research, I have not, for especially around the normative. I think the cultural scripts research definitely applies to lots of different cultural populations. That really is, that the context of that is a real cultural basis, and so. In any context, it would be identifying kind of what the cultural scripts are that are specific to that population. As far as misperceived norms, I would have to look to see whether those results are replicated. They're a little bit premised on the idea of individual beliefs, and I think that there's populations where the kind of normative information would be based more on the community or shared beliefs. And so, but I suspect there would be misperceptions, but we might just have to get at them a little bit different so that you think that most people do something in some way, but really what's true is more typical. So,
right.
Maddie?
Yeah, and, you know, I will emphasize that these populations are a particular concern because of their higher rates of completed suicide, which is why I'm sure you're asking the question, as well as higher rates of suicide clusters. There isn't much work that have specifically examined suicide modeling in these behaviors, but in these populations, but there have been some. And there's one where I guess the senior author was John Walkup, and I can, you know, I don't have the reference at my fingertips, but that there clearly are some studies that have been focused on these populations specifically with regard to modeling behavior in them. Because they, I mean, we certainly see the narratives in the media, but with regard to, you know, systematic research, there's not been much, but there has been some. So if you're interested in that, I can, you know, add that to the resource, you know, resources that are provided, you know, after we get off.
Great. We're going to move on. Still some great questions coming in, so we'll get to those later. But I wanted to apologize. I think maybe I was vague when I mentioned where the link to the slides is posted. I apologize. You can go to the SPRC website. They're actually, the link is, we can post the link in the chat in a moment, but it's not currently up there. I apologize. It'll be on our website, www.sprc.org, and you'll click on the left-hand side on research, on the Training Institute, and then Research to Practice webinars. So I apologize for that. And we will have the link to our website at the end of the presentation. So thank you all for bearing with us. And now I'm going to introduce our final speaker, Ken Norton, who serves as the Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in New Hampshire. Ken led the development of the CONNECT training program for prevention, intervention, and postvention, which is listed in the SPRC AFSP Best Practices Registry for Suicide Prevention. He was instrumental in the passage of legislation to establish a state suicide prevention council in New Hampshire. And as a member of that council, he has participated in the revision of the New Hampshire State Suicide Prevention Plan. Ken has served on numerous committees and work groups focused on suicide prevention, intervention, and postvention for civilian and military populations. And he was also very active in the recent revision of the National Media Recommendations for reporting on suicide. Ken has been personally impacted by suicide, and this fuels his passion for suicide prevention efforts. So, Tiffany, if you could unmute Ken's line.
Thank you. And let's see. So I'd like to start by just saying that, you know, as we're thinking about how we're going to act on the local level, that we really want to focus, you know, think globally and act locally. And that's so important in terms of particularly the new age of where media and news and narratives is presented so rapidly across the internet. And we'll talk a little bit about that towards the end. But also want to mention that, you know, that the whole piece around media recommendations and working with the media is part of the national strategy and is probably part of many of your state plans as well. And it's something that sometimes is overlooked in favor of other strategies. And certainly this webinar is encouraging you to look at how you can participate in that. And although I'm going to use some national examples today as well as some local ones, the idea with the national ones was that folks would get to see, it would be common things that everybody understands. So I'd like to start with just people raising hands about how many of the participants on the webinar have distributed the media recommendations to your local media.
And just to let people know to raise your hand, you'll open the attendee list and you'll see a little hand button. I believe we're getting some rolling in.
Okay, so we'll keep, you know, people can keep doing that and we'll come back to it. So these are the recently updated recommendations for reporting on suicide. And as Maddie mentioned, we call them recommendations rather than guidelines because linguistics are important and how we talk about things, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But the idea that they're, you know, recommendations, because that's all we can really do is recommend. We can't in any way control, although in some other countries they do control more how media reports around suicide. And the, you know, some of the features around the media recommendations are that that there is on the second page, there's a sidebar, which is what you see in blue on the right-hand side of your screen, and that's intended to be copied right into a newspaper, and it has information about warning signs and what to do if you think somebody is suicidal, and as well as the information about the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And then some of the other features are that instead of doing, you know, this, you might do that, and gives also some information about social networking and those types of things. So we know that, as we heard from Maddie, that research shows that how reports in the media are presented around suicide may contribute to contagion. And those, you know, are things like oversimplifying and overstating the frequency and prominent placement of the stories, glamorization of suicide, those different things that were already mentioned. And the you know, what we're trying to get at is what Linda characterized in terms of that action-promoting information. So what we want reporters to report on is about how to get help, about what, you know, that there have been advances made in the area of treating mental illness and substance use, and what the warning signs are, and then how at the local level or where at the local level people can turn to get help. So, you know, in terms of sort of the this particular story was, you know, a media template at the local level where, you know, in this particular community in New Hampshire on the seacoast where there's a large bridge, there had been frequent suicide deaths. So it's kind of reported in that, yes, it's another person who's died by jumping from the bridge. And this is an example where even though the narrative is not the narrative that we want and the picture is not the narrative that we want, that we end up with a piece of what we do want, which is the sidebar box that's talking about needing help and some of the local resources as well as some of the warning signs for getting help. And, you know, that's, I think, important to recognize that all stories are not good and bad, and that the process of changing narratives is a process, and you have to look for small accomplishments in that. So, you know, part of what's important when we think about how we're going to change those narratives is to look at what the culture is. And specifically in this example, the culture is journalist culture and understanding how journalists are trained. And they're trained to focus on the facts, who, what, when, where, how, and why sometimes. And to have a very strong skepticism of authority, questioning authority, and having a, you know, real independence in terms of how they're reporting. So, you know, understand that when you're presenting them with media recommendations, they may be very skeptical of, you know, why they should follow them or the research that's behind that, and you should embrace that skepticism by encouraging them to look at some of the research and to check some of that out. And, you know, also understand that, you know, that our culture, you know, creates that too, because our culture is that we want this 24/7 that gives very detailed information and sometimes very personal or tawdry details. And, you know, and now that can be tracked in terms of online media outlets are seeing what people are clicking on and what people are hitting on, and that can drive some of that piece. The piece that we want to really focus on is how do we want to engage media, and you know, and we want to engage them in a way that that is respectful, and you know, and looks at what their role is in terms of reporting on the news, and to develop long-term relationships with them. If we're talking with them about a story that was written or whatever, we really need to be focusing on the next story. We can, you know, talk about the previous story, but you know, your real goal is to get them to focus on the next one. And want to invite them to, you know, participate and to be active participants in your local coalition meetings. And that will in some ways co-opt them. And then it's important to identify local experts who can provide information. And it's important that when you're giving the names of those local experts, that those local experts are aware of what the narrative is that you want locally or how you want to guide that narrative. And some of that might be use of the safe messaging recommendations that are available on the SPRC website. So, you know, the other aspect of this that's really key is to get out in front of the news. And because we have a very reactive news cycle, we sometimes, once the story's out, we're already running behind and it's going to be very difficult to kind of capture it. And so we want to get out in front of the news and provide local angles and, you know, maybe even work with your medical examiner and your coroner who would alert you at the point where there might be a story that is going to be explosive around a particular narrative so that you can try and get out in front of that. You know, for instance, we were getting a lot of narratives locally about foreclosures resulting in suicide deaths. And so we brought SPRC in to do a public forum to talk about economic factors and the connection to suicide. And really, we're able to engage media in that forum and in reporting on that as a way of changing some of that narrative. And again, as sort of it was mentioned before, one of those angles is that you want to, you know, on any given day when there might have been somebody who died by suicide because of a foreclosure, there were many, 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 many other people who sought other ways of coping. And, you know, and that's the story that we want to create. The media's, you know, current policy around suicide is that they generally don't cover suicide deaths, and the exception are when it's a public person or it happens in a public area or it's sort of quote-unquote newsworthy. And when one of those three things occur, all bets are off. And we really want to change that whole dynamic because we want them to report on suicide. And, you know, we want it reported as a public health issue has been talked about. And, you know, we have to take responsibility that that on a collective level that we've failed to capture the public sentiment in terms of the importance of suicide as being preventable, that, you know, that other areas like HIV have been very successful in getting that message across. The media can be a tool to help us create that narrative, and they can do that because they have a long history of doing that around other issues, like coverage around use of seatbelts or life preservers or smoking, all those different things. And also, you know, the National Action Alliance, which many people are probably familiar with, is also a real great opportunity for us to change that narrative as well. So, you know, that key narrative that we want to communicate is that suicide is preventable. We can talk about the Surgeon General's report. We can provide stories about people who have made suicide attempts, either locally or nationally, and lived, and talk about their recovery and how they got help and how they changed their life. We can get information from our local crisis centers that are part of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and they have many success stories in terms of where they've intervened effectively. And we really want to emphasize that effectiveness of treatment for mental health. Another way to change the narrative is to ask for editorial board meetings. And editorial boards are really issue-oriented. You'll go in, you'll be on the record. They'll bring in various editors from the newspaper, and you probably want to bring somebody along with you, a local mental health expert, somebody who's lost a loved one to suicide, or perhaps somebody who has even previously attempted suicide. And one of the nice things about the editorial board is if they write an editorial in support of suicide being preventable or mental health treatment or whatever your narrative is, once they've done that, they will kind of guide the news in that direction and be very supportive of that position moving forward. A couple of other techniques that you might use are op-ed pieces, where you write a piece that goes on the editorial page yourself, or even letters to the editor can be helpful in that regard. And this is an example of one editorial board where we were able to get an editorial written by a major newspaper talking about that suicide is preventable. So another common script that we end up fighting against is that explanation of causality that's very simplistic. And, you know, in the case of Phoebe Prince, people are probably very familiar with this young woman. And what we see were many of these headlines that she was bullied to death. And yet, you know, based on, you know, the fine print in some news stories, the full picture identified many other stressors and risk factors, that she had moved to a new country, that her parents were divorced, that she had had a recent breakup with a boyfriend, she'd had a previous history of suicide attempt, a history of depression. So there's really a much bigger picture, and that's the narrative that we want to get across. So in this case, you know, did Phoebe die because of bullying, or did she die due to the failure to recognize a high prevalence of risk factors and intervene accordingly? So, you know, one of the other areas is around fighting misinformation. And, you know, and in this case, this is the example of the military. While it's certainly a national problem, I'd also encourage you to look at it as a local issue and how you might intervene to support your National Guard or reserves in your state. And half of the suicide deaths in those populations are people who have never deployed, but that's really not covered by the media. And, you know, one thing that you can do is look at age-adjusted or gender-adjusted rates, which tend to mitigate what appears to be this, or is reported as, you know, as sort of an epidemic. And then, you know, this is an example of turning the sort of story on its head by promoting success stories. So what is the opposite of the narrative that you're contending with, and how can you deal with it? And this is, you know, that, you know, what Linda had referred to earlier is that mastery of crisis, that in this case, you know, this was a general who is coming forward and saying that that he had had very severe struggles with PTSD and issues related to, you know, to previous deployments. And, you know, and he got out of that sort of mindset of that he had to tough it out, and he asked for help. And it was only after pushing from his wife that he did that. But, you know, but that had a huge piece in changing that that narrative. Some other narratives where we've seen similar things is a cluster where, you know, there were a lot of reports about how many suicides there were in a community, and we were able to change that narrative over time to all of the different efforts that were occurring in that community by different organizations and individuals to prevent suicide and to promote mental health treatment. So, you know, one of the other things that's really key is that we become involved with new media. As I mentioned at the beginning, we know that the internet is now a prime source for news, and it's also really a prime place where those narratives are created and carried out. There's a real blur now between news organizations and social networking sites, and most of them are very closely connected with icons, and you can send a story out to your social networking site or whatever. So you can have an active presence by posting something, you know, a statement about a story or commenting, and in that way changing the narrative like you might write a letter to the editor. And then, you know, the sort of the key point that I want to make about this, and we've heard some about this narrative, particularly around LGBT youth, but I want us to reflect for ourselves about how we might inadvertently contribute to negative narratives. Do our materials and our presentations overstate the frequency of suicide by providing lots and lots and lots of data and statistics without, you know, putting it in the context of that it's really a very rare occurrence? And, you know, do some of our broad efforts inadvertently contribute to this? In the case of Tyler Clementi, many of the folks who were LGBT advocates and even suicide prevention advocates inadvertently contributed to that negative narrative. So we really need to look at ourselves carefully in that regard. And then finally, what is the script that you want? What's the script that you want for your community and locally? And hopefully that includes some of those pieces that we've talked about, that suicide is preventable and that it is a public health issue, and information about the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline and local resources. And then, you know, we didn't cover a lot of sort of the very basic stuff about working with the media, but this is a great guide that's available through the FPRC library that was developed a couple of years ago about how to engage the media in suicide prevention efforts. And so that is a great resource for folks. And then this is my contact info.
Thanks so much, Ken. That's such a helpful sort of practical overview of, and we really appreciate your sharing your experiences. So I wanted to first apologize. Apparently the link to the PDF of the slides doesn't work. We'll have that fixed momentarily, but I apologize for misleading you in the meantime. And I'd like to first take any questions that folks have for Ken Norton, to give him a little time to talk more about his experiences. And then we can also open it up if people have general questions, and we still have some questions pending from our other presenters. Ken, while you were talking, one specific question came in around editorial board meetings and how do you go about asking for one of those or getting into one of those?
Great. You know, you would call your local editor and ask whether they would be interested in having an editorial board meeting, whether they do them regularly anyway. Some news organizations do, some news organizations don't. And then whether they would be interested in having you come in and present on the issue. So it's and part of that might be the longer term process of just developing a relationship with folks. That particular example that I gave you came from a very negative story narrative that was covered widely by press in New Hampshire, and that created an opportunity to follow up about changing that narrative. And the news organizations themselves sort of realized that they had not covered it very well, and that provided that opportunity for an editorial board.
Great. Thank you. There's a few questions coming in. There are a few questions about, and I think you've given some strategies, but for suicide prevention practitioners who are in the media, or for people who are really trying to get the guidelines to the media, you've given us a lot of strategies, but sort of what is the role for people who have that dual role of being a suicide prevention practitioner and also a media person? Is there a special role they can play?
Well, I think that's a great question. The role is to use that to your advantage by maybe educating peers about, particularly in the media world, about suicide prevention and about how to go about reporting on suicide, because it isn't an us and them thing. It's really about partnering and collaboration. And I think once you're able to get into that role with media and media sees you as a resource, that can become very important. One example I'd like to mention is that, sometimes we work with a particular reporter or a journalist, and they write a terrific story, and then the headline comes out, and the headline is horrible. And, and we hear from the reporter that they're mortified that, that they didn't write the headline, the editor wrote the headline. So it's really important to sort of recognize that, that there's hierarchies even within news organizations, and that that it's important to, to work across those different places as well, with editors as well as with reporters and publishers.
Great. I have one other very specific question, but I'm curious now about whether you've heard of this. Someone mentions that the United Way has a United Front website that can offer editorial narratives for community news. So that might be a way to shape positive success stories around suicide prevention. And the person was asking if you had ever had any experience with the United Way or United Front.
I've not, but, another great resource that's available in most communities is your local cable access TV. And, and many of them have some type of, regular programming around, human services, or might just welcome you to come in and, and do a half hour, an hour long show. And you could sort of create a panel and really essentially define your own narrative that way through the use of local access TV.
Great idea. Tiffany, if you can unmute our other presenters as well. There are a few more general questions coming in, but Ken, maybe you can start answering this one. The question is, given that fewer than 5% of suicides are attributed to contagion, how much of our community resources should we devote to trying to influence media coverage?
I'll take that, because that was from some of our work. I want to emphasize that was an estimate of suicide clusters and, a very specific phenomenon, relatively contained community in a given time period. And even when we gave that estimate, we really put the caveat around that conclusion that it didn't include all instances of suicide modeling. So if there was, one additional suicide that occurred after someone's, suicide, that wouldn't be counted. And that I think that the effect size of the Vienna guidelines really highlights the potential for these recommendations. because if you do have a method that's very, you know, prevalent in the community, and that's where, you know, culturally specific recommendations are needed, as well as both Linda and Ken suggested, that, you know, we saw that 75% decrease in suicides. So clearly, suicide modeling and the impact of the media is not the major cause of suicide. We know that it's, you know, untreated or undertreated, you know, psychopathology. But there is enough of an impact that it can make a starting, you know, really a, it's startling how big an impact, you know, addressing this issue could have, I think, on decreasing suicide. So I want to say that that 5% is an underestimate as well.
Okay.
You know, it's not going to be 50%, but
right.
You know, but that particular estimate is an underestimate. So I'm glad that you brought it up.
And this is Linda. I just want to say quickly that I think a lot of prevention folks are spending significant resources on public awareness and communications, and to the extent that these narratives are kind of undermining, you can have the best brochure or website in the world, but if the kind of day-to-day drumbeat of the media is this narrative, then those resources are not as well used than if messages are more in alignment across those areas.
Right. I think there's another couple of ideas that people have actually been sharing about
Great.
The broadcast news directors and the Unity Conference in Las Vegas with Asian, Hispanic, and Native American news people and key decision makers. People are mentioning the Carter Center's mental health program that has mental health journalism fellowships. And I'm wondering if the three of you could comment on whether there's a group sort of in the suicide prevention field that is leading, or is there perhaps a group of organizations that are sort of leading the effort at the national level to really communicate these guidelines or recommendations and work hand-in-hand with the journalism community to really make some changes?
Ken, do you want to talk about meeting with Poynter?
Sure. And then maybe, Maddie, you can talk about
mm-hmm.
Columbia. Or,
yes, that'd be good.
You know, as I had mentioned previously, one area is the National Action Alliance, and, you know, and they do have a work group that is focused particularly on the entertainment industry, and there has been some work done with the entertainment industry as well. As we were about to release the media recommendations this spring, a group of us that had worked on the revised recommendations went to the Poynter Institute. It's Poynter, and it's poynter.org. And they are essentially the SPRC of the journalism world. That's where journalists turn to for technical assistance. And we met with them, and that's a great sort of resource for you to go or to direct journalists to, in terms of to see articles that are well done in terms of following media recommendations, and they have information there. And at that meeting were folks from the broadcast news industry, the television news industry, the radio news industry, national leaders who talked about how they might work to disseminate that within their the new recommendations within their national organizations.
And I just want to highlight what Ken had said about, you know, thinking globally and acting locally. So here at Columbia University, that there is a collaboration underway between the School of Journalism, their DART Center, and the Department of Psychiatry. And the School of Journalism has obtained funding from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention to develop educational material and presentations for journalists, students, but also, you know, working journalists and reporters, and that they'll be starting in New York because it's locally, and that I think that the first workshop is probably going to occur in February of, you know, this upcoming year, and then they're hoping to be able to do similar workshops across the country. And the fact that the main mover of this program is the School of Journalism is something that I don't think would have happened, you know, 20 years ago. So I'm delighted to see that they recognize the, you know, the need to educate their colleagues into the, you know, a more productive way of, you know, providing these narratives. And, you know, they also are, you know, very cognizant of new media journalism. And so, as, you know, an earlier question had asked with regard to, you know, research in this area and efforts in this area, you know, we're recognizing that that is, you know, a need that has to be addressed both by practice and research. And the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline has been working with social media sites such as, you know, Facebook and MySpace with regard to helping respond to suicidal threats or content on their sites. And they have a postvention, an online postvention manual or guidelines. And mm-hmm. so that, you know, I think that they're trying to address, you know, the new technologies with regard to both reporting and responding to suicide.
Great. Thank you so much to all three of you for answering some of those big picture questions as well. Unfortunately, we're out of time. So I'd like to thank all of you, thank our presenters once again for sharing their insights and expertise. I want to apologize again for the technical difficulties we're having with the PDF of the presentation. Please do check back at that link, and we should have it fixed by tomorrow morning at the latest. So thank you for your patience. I want to thank all of you who participated, and to let you know you'll be receiving an email in the next day or so requesting that you fill out a brief evaluation of this session, and we really hope you'll take a few short minutes to let us know how useful the webinar was for you and how we can do even better in future webinars. Again, please do check back on our website. This is the link to our website here. And if you have any further questions, you can also contact our project coordinator, Tiffany Kim, at this number and email address on your screen. And this concludes our webinar. So thank you all very much, and have a great rest of your week.